Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Greg Rusevich. Greg was the CEO of Transoceanic Shipping during Katrina, but he has been involved on so many different fronts in the city, to include parish chairman of the New Orleans Crime Coalition. He was chair of the Metropolitan Crime Commission and also chairman of Louisiana Board of International Commerce. He is heavily engaged in a lot of things in the city, and obviously cares a lot about the city and cared about the rebirth and the reengineering of the city. And he joins us now. Greg, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Dool. Thanks for that really kind introduction. Thank you for that. Very kind. Thanks.
Greg, so take us back. You know, you're the CEO of Transoceanic Shipping. You work a lot, you know, relative to the port, the importance of SAME. We hadn't heard from a lot of folks about, you know, port activities and shipping and what that meant in the aftermath and the challenges in the aftermath of Katrina.
Yeah, well, there are two things. One, in terms of the port, you know, the port was one of the first operating entities to come back, and really Gary LaGrange played such a critical part, he and his team coming back at the time. And really, we had to have the port open just like we had to have the airport open, because that's how goods and were being delivered, and that's how supplies were being delivered for the recovery. And so the river was absolutely critical, and the port was absolutely critical. Obviously, in terms of our own shipping activities and everyone else's shipping activities from the private sector, they were very limited, naturally, and we had to find other ports to really have commerce to use. But Newell, what it really led to, because as we came back, you know, a group of our all, you know, the business leaders that came back at the time, in our own specific spheres, in mine, commerce and shipping. But we really had to figure a way to rebuild the community. We really put, frankly, more time not only into rebuilding the businesses, and we all had great teams that did that, but really we had to focus on the rebuilding of the community. And that's really, looking back at Katrina, what was so special to me is building those relationships and building those coalitions that really helped, I think, rebuild the city at the time. Because as you remember, we had a lot of divides. There were a lot of racial divides, a lot of ideological divides. And to me, it was really about figuring out a way to move those aside and focus on what the critical issues were, and just keep it issue focused, and then build multiracial coalitions to attack the urgent needs in the city. So from the private sector, yes, Newell, I mean, the ports, shipping, my own company, we came back, you know, but we really made Houston our hub until we were able to fully bring everybody back, and which we did. But really what became the focus was really a dual fold, and it was, you know, 20-hour days, because you were both running your business, but at the same time, bring the community back. Because if we didn't bring our community back, we had no business. So you had to figure out a way to get the education system back in line. We, in my case, to really help on the criminal justice situation. Rafi was a big part of that. Rafi Guarnacci playing a role in it. We had to bring the economy back. Michael Hecht played the critical role there. All of the pieces, and then we had to build coalitions multiracially, because that we had to find ways to make sure that the Urban League and the Business Council and GNO Inc. were all working together, and the Black Chamber and the Hispanic Chamber and the New Orleans Chamber were all working together. And that was one real challenge, and one that I'm very proud we got through in flying colors, and, you know, had a beautiful spirit of working together. And it was all about focus on issues. Specific issues that were addressing us. None of this historical divide or ideological divide. We left all that at the doorstep and just focused on what was the best for the quality of life for the citizenry, all citizenry.
You know, for me, from my perspective, I think there were some people that were focused on the divide. They kind of even wanted the divide in many respects. But there was no game plan. Nobody had ever gone through this before, right? So there was not a script to follow. And as people, you know, I remember being involved in a bunch of these meetings. I know I was in meetings with you and law enforcement. The JPSO did a lot for the NOPD. It's not often talked about, but it's amazing how much, you know, the men and women of that of the JPSO covered for them retrieving bodies, setting up the DMAT, setting up disaster mortuary, disaster medical assistant teams, and the like, even down to giving the NOPD 200 weapons because most of their equipment was destroyed.
Huh.
But it seemed to me that a lot that went on was trying to figure out, and I recall the conversations, how was government going to be financed because there was no tax base. And they, you know, there was a big concern. I know from my perspective as the tax collector, I kept telling folks, you better figure out how to get some business, you know, and micro business centers around the city back up and running so that you have a revenue stream coming in. Because at some point, that federal spigot, they turning that sucker off. And if you don't,
right.
if you don't get this
right.
started, you yeah. we may not recover. You know, and it was that uncertainty, not having a script, you know, that I think people were thinking out loud and some folks were getting punished for it, quite frankly.
Well, right. And the city government was totally unresponsive in the years following Newell. And not only that first year, but the first 3 or 4 years following Katrina, the city government was completely unresponsive to the needs of the citizens of New Orleans. And what happened is that it was unresponsive to all citizens. So businesses needed to have a safe place that their employees and their families could live, work, and run a business. And at the same time, you know, people in other parts of the community needed schools they could send their kids to and be educated. They needed safe neighborhoods, which they didn't have. And it was affecting everything. So I would walk into meetings, and we realized that we had to build coalitions. And I would get regularly together with Dr. Cowan, you know, Mike Cowan, who is a great civic leader and still is. And Mike had an umbrella organization called Common Good, which was very interracial and very faith, you know, faith leaders were involved, all the interracially in every way, shape, and form. So we reached out to that group through the Business Council and business groups and GNO Inc. and Metropolitan Crime Commission, and all came together. And, of course, you had the same thing, Newell, where there was one part of the conversation that wanted to talk about, you know, structural racism and wanted to really talk about the historical divides. And we made a very conscious decision, all of us together at that table, except for the outliers, that we were not going to do that. Instead, what we were going to do, and we've kept that going to today, we were only going to focus on issues, specific issues that were holding the city back, and fix those issues. And we're able to all come together and say, yes, this is what we need to do on crime. We have to have more cops. And so, for example, when we said we have to have more cops, there was one part of the community that said, yes, but we want them in our community. And we said, great, we want community policing. And then we said we need more prosecutors. And we actually went to Washington to get funding for additional prosecutors because the DA's office was completely, you know, there were no prosecutors. So we got funding yep. for prosecutors. And at the same time, one part of the community said, well, if you get more prosecutors, we need more public defenders. And we said, great, we agree. Let's improve the whole system, get more public defenders and more prosecutors. So we were able to have that balance, Newell, and people of goodwill can find balance and find agreement. And we were able to do that. I think much of that lives on to today through the NOLA Coalition and through others that we sort of started building the foundation back then for. So I think that was one of the key takeaways, that when we find things that we agree on instead of big things that we disagree on, we can get a lot done. If we get stuck in the mud debating long-term historical issues and divides, we get nothing done. It's best peel back the issue, get the facts of the matter, and then go fix the issue as a multiracial coalition. That, I think, has been the key to any success that the city has had over our recent years and since Katrina.
Yeah, there's no doubt, and there's so many things that are big and better, obviously, since that point in time. And then there's still the underbelly, right? The challenges that we're still facing and some of the stuff that we can't seem to get out of our own way.
Yeah, and I think we're back to sort of where we were in terms of an unresponsive city government. So obviously that's front and center now in the mayor's race and in the council races. What we need is back exactly where we were. We're not quite as severe. You can't meet the tragedy of Katrina or match it. But we're in many ways back to where we were. You've got an unresponsive city government. You have so many areas of city governance that just don't work and is not serving the people. And it's not serving any of the people. So it's not, again, it's colorblind. It's every neighborhood it's not working, from St. Charles Avenue to the 7th Ward to the 9th Ward. So, in the French Quarter even, that needs to be cleaned up and needs to be safe. So you've got these elements across the city that we had back then, and we need that playbook once again to just focus on what is best way to fix these issues, and we must have city leaders that are accountable and responsible. And you remember we had Fall New Orleans that we launched, Newell, and Fall New Orleans is a way to really make sure that the political leadership is keeping its word and meeting its promises and mandates, and that's all through coalitions and making sure that they're pledging and keeping those mandates. So we have to hold the political leadership accountable, and one more point, you have to be regional in your thinking, and we've lost that too. You bring up a really good point about the way the JPSO helped NOPD, saved NOPD at the time, and we can learn so much regionally, and we have to work together more regionally because that has really stopped the last 5 years, 8 years. And so we should be using one another's best practices and approaching matters regionally. Every issue we approach, we have to approach it regionally. Crime is just one example where technology works across boundaries. And obviously, cooperation between federal, state, and law enforcement, local law enforcement, regional law enforcement has to work together. So we need to really tear down the boundary lines and be working as a regional group as well. We can do a lot more regionally than we can in a silo.
Obviously, I think that's compelling for the next 20 years. Because my next question to you is going to be what you think the biggest challenge is moving forward, in the next 20. I mean, I think in a lot of respects, we've moved forward. We've made significant gains. We've kind of diversified our economy. Not as much. It's never as diverse as you want it to be, right? But we've made some significant strides there. Got some big projects, not only here locally that we're working on, whether it's Venture Global or if you're thinking about the Lit, the improvements in the port. What's going on down there along the Convention Center Boulevard with that project. But the next 20, because we still have this big challenge of out-migration, population loss. I say this all the time. I think you agree with me, Greg. We need to move from a third tier to a second tier city. And that's about people. And we find ourselves in a situation we need more.
Yeah, we've lost a dramatic, we were just in a meeting yesterday, we've lost a dramatic, the stat I saw, we've lost 10, New Orleans has lost 10% of its population over the last 10 years, which is, I think, the largest of any city, metropolitan city across the nation. Regionally, we've lost about 4%. Those are all dramatic numbers, particularly the New Orleans number. And I think there are two things we need to do, and I'm not just the only one saying this, Newell, but it's really prevalent in the business community and every conversation I'm in, is really two things. Number one, fix the quality of life issues. It's unacceptable that the quality of life issues are not fixed. And it should never be accepted to just be mediocre. So we have to strive for excellence in everything in quality of life issues. Every issue across the city needs to be fixed. There's no reason for it not to be the critical issues I'm talking about. That's number one. Number two, connected directly to that, is we need to really have an attitude that appreciates business. I mean, businesses are the ones creating jobs. So you talk about the River District. You talk about Shell that's putting its headquarters down there. Right at the center of the River District. You have Entergy that's supplying energy. They're the only Fortune 500 company that's still here. You go across the board. Yes, we need to hold the corporate community accountable, but we also need to understand they are who brings the jobs. And so we need to be very, we need to figure out a way to make this a place that appreciates business, that rolls out the welcome mat for new businesses, and that finds out what we can do. City leadership needs to be understanding from the better dialogue with the business community of what the business community needs in order to build and prosper here and grow jobs. Because if businesses build and grow, what happens? The jobs occur, additional jobs. And there's been a historic tension here between the business community and a city hall, which is absolutely unacceptable. So whatever candidate is really the friendliest toward a business is really equaling friendliest toward jobs. And you can rant and rave against businesses all you want, but they're the ones producing the jobs. So if you want jobs and you want city finances, you need to be demonstrating appreciation and cooperation.
Isn't it funny that we don't view government as a business here? I mean, because one, if you did, you would be focused on revenue enhancement, right? And revenue enhancement would be drawing new businesses to this place, having a larger population base, more property taxpayers, more sales taxpayers. Right. You would have a strategy around that. And we just have this kind of disjointed approach, and we don't want to right-size government at the same time. So we're not going to cut, we're not going to enhance revenue, and we really believe that we're going to succeed in status quo? I don't know of anybody that succeeds in status quo.
Exactly. Know? No, and that's all the cities are making the tough choices. They don't go through this. The other cities that are prospering, you know, we're going to have a significant budget deficit in the city next year, and I haven't heard anybody talk about where the cuts are going to come, but they're going to have to really, and the way to do that, Newell, as you know, is take your priorities. We know what the top priorities are. There's been polling after polling showing those priorities. Make sure those are completely funded. Crime, streets, sewage, make sure all the infrastructure, make sure those are funded. And everything else, you're just going to have to make difficult decisions in, because businesses cannot pay and people can't pay more than they're paying right now. They're already, it's already running people out of the city. So if you look at models like Charleston and Tampa and Nashville, and we can name them forever, Austin, those cities are all growing and they're making tough decisions. They've got good cooperation between their city government and the business community. They're figuring out a way ways to grow jobs. They're figuring out a way to grow the tax base, and they're very responsive on governance issues. So if there's something that the community, that citizens are not receiving, those city governments go in and they fix it. So they don't tolerate a street, you know, lack of street repair and not, you know, a French Quarter that's our crown jewel not being spick and span and safe as can be. These are just obvious things that are not that we debate that we shouldn't be debating. And so we have a long way to go, Newell, but I do think that that spirit from Katrina, we need to get that spirit back and be working together multiracially, be focused on the issues. Everyone agrees that jobs are critical. Jobs are produced by the private sector, by businesses. Everyone agrees that we need streets that need to work and drivable streets. Good schools, playgrounds. Nord is another example that's been completely broken. We have to fix Nord completely and just find the best way to do it, private-public model. And just things need to be fixed. And then, well, I think we can get ourselves out of the hole and at least get back even to Tier 2, as you said, and then we can build from there.
You know, in all those cities that have redefined, re-engineered themselves, what I think the common theme that I see, it's not always worded this way, but you set the bar and you're not willing to accept anything less, going right to that word that you said earlier, attitude.
And, you know, absolutely. And a sense of urgency toward it, a sense of urgency, pride, and thriving for excellence, and not accepting anything other than excellence, no longer accepting mediocrity.
Music to my ears, my friend. Greg Rusevich, thank you so much for joining us. Keep up the great work. We appreciate it. We are very lucky to have you, and have a great Labor Day weekend.
Thank you, Newell. You too. Thank you very, very much. You too. Thank you.
All righty. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Fighting Tigers. Chris, welcome to the show.
Newell, great to be with you once again. It's finally here. It's game week, man. We're just a couple of days out from kickoff.
Man, I can sense the excitement in your voice, Chris.
I'm ready to go. Ready to go. Let's get there. Saturday can't get here quick enough.
Absolutely. The number nine LSU Fighting Tigers take on the Clemson number four Clemson Tigers. Not unlike all other SEC stadiums, that's not an easy place to win in.
No, it's not. You know, I worked at Clemson for five seasons way back when, and, you know, they got a great tradition there. And, again, they like their Clemson football, and certainly can't argue with, for the most part, Dabo Sweeney's tenure there as head coach. Certainly from about 2014 on, they suddenly took a major step forward and played for titles, won a couple, and, again, typically are in the mix. I know the last couple of years, probably for Clemson standards, or at least the current Clemson standards, maybe not as well as they would have liked to perform. But, you know, talking to people I know there and just watching the media, obviously a number four preseason ranking, they're going to be excited about this year's team. I'm not sure yet if it's quite the talent on paper that some of those teams had with Deshaun Watson and his college career, and obviously Trevor Lawrence, who LSU defeated in the title game in 2019 there in New Orleans. But I think the optimism is there. So Dabo Sweeney called for an orange out Saturday, so looking to see a lot of purple and gold kind of break up all that orange when we get to Frank Howard Field Memorial Stadium on Saturday night.
What do you see as the big challenges for LSU?
You know, I think it's going to be the run game again. I mean, obviously, I'll talk about defense in just a little bit, but I think LSU, you know, with the offense they have, which at times was very prolific. In fact, you can go back, you know, the last couple of years, and obviously Jaden Daniels, when he was the quarterback, he kind of was the runner in the run game, you know, and that's not Garrett's style. But I think, you know, there's some good running backs LSU has, and I think to really open up the playbook, LSU's got to be efficient running the football. I mean, just imagine, not that you're going to run on every first down, but if you do and suddenly you're looking at second and three as opposed to second and 10 on an incompletion, suddenly your playbook opens up. And, of course, Garrett's got plenty of great weapons around him, both, I think, at running back as well as the wide receiver and tight end position. So I just think it opens things up for you. So to me, offensively, I think LSU is going to be fine. They got great playmakers wherever you look. You know, it's a new offensive line, basically, replacing Will Campbell and Emory Jones. But I think running the ball will just make things so much more dynamic for this offense. And the big question, obviously, is defensively. That's something LSU has struggled with the last couple of seasons. You know, there were games they had to outscore people to win. There were games where they just couldn't do it, and they couldn't stop the opponent. You know, a couple of games last year where dual threat quarterbacks, ran rampant. You know, Klubnik averaged last year about 33 yards a carry. He's a dual threat. He's got the ability to do it. It's not as if he's, you know, going to be out there running around like Jaden Daniels did. But I'm sure Clemson, you know, paid close attention to the film from last year for LSU on their inability sometimes to be able to stop that type of attack. So I think defensively, with the playmakers they brought in, some of the younger guys that got thrown in and baptized by fire last year, I expect LSU's defense, and you can hear Coach Kelly each week this season during fall camp and leading up to the game, really feels like this defense has taken some major strides forward. So to me, those are the two things. Can we run the ball offensively, and can we get back to the type of LSU defense that this school, this program, and certainly these fans are accustomed to?
The SEC season is a tough one, right? And, I mean, it's tough from the very beginning, and you always have to be focused on depth. As we look at this year's team compared to last year's team, both offensively and defensively, your thoughts about depth. I thought last year we couldn't end up outscoring a lot of people because we had a little bit of a depth problem, in my view. I don't know what your thoughts are, but how do you see it this year?
Yeah, I think Coach Kelly has said that. That's kind of stood out to me just listening to him over the last several weeks and months, and that's about depth at some key positions. And, you know, it certainly starts at the offensive line. While you lose those two heralded players I talked about, you know, Braylon Moore comes in. He's kind of settled things down as center, transferring him from Virginia Tech. And when you talk to the coaches, they kind of talk about how maybe you don't have – at least yet, that individual standout that you had last year. But as a team, as a total unit, this may be a better offensive line. He's talking about rotating, you know, as many as 6, 7, 8 guys on the offensive line. I think that probably will be the early part of the season, because I think eventually, barring injury or just giving a guy a breather, you want to kind of get some continuity there, and I'm sure that's what they're going to do. But, I mean, the fact that they've got that type of bodies, that not only – are listed as offensive linemen, but they feel pretty good about what they do up there. That's just one area. I think the defensive front, with the addition of Jack Pyburn from Florida and Patrick Payton from Florida State, Jacobian Guillory coming back after being injured last year. Now all of a sudden you're talking about some really key names along with other transfers on that defensive front. So you're looking at the tip of the spear, both for offensive and defensive lines, that, again, it goes to a lot more depth than we saw last year and certainly the year before that, and certainly in Coach Kelly's first year. The wide receiver position, which has been phenomenal really for a long time here at LSU, is almost laughable, the abundance of riches they have. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people across our league, and they feel like there's 7 or 8 guys that they're going to have to rotate at that wide receiver position that would play – a lot of snaps at a lot of SEC schools, a lot of Power Four schools. I think the depth is why this team on paper, again, I like to say everything on paper until you get on the field and the lights come on, the crowd's there. I think this is why it's the most talented team Coach Kelly's had, and he's been saying that for quite a while now.
Last year's defensive play, with some of the challenges they had on the defensive line, it seemed that it put a lot of pressure on linebacker, and there was a question as to whether or not we really had the speed that we thought we had, but I'm hearing a lot from Baton Rouge this year that they feel like defensively, this is one of their fastest defensive units. Is that true from your perspective?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I believe so, having seen practice. I mean, they're flying around the football, and I thought it was interesting, you know, a couple of the sessions that the media has been able to take in. You know, one of the things I hear from them is, wow, the defense is really kind of stingy out there when they go 11 on 11 or even 9 on 9, which, you know, all of a sudden there's all this worry about the offense. I think the offense is going to be just fine. I think that's a better sign for this defense being able to cover the field sideline to sideline. And I also think a lot of times last year at the linebacker position, you were asking those guys to actually break through the line of scrimmage to get to the football. I think that, mm-hmm. you know, again, relies on your defensive front to be able to allow the guys like Wes Weeks and Whit Weeks and even Harold Perkins Jr. to make those kind of plays, that they're not fighting the defensive front or they're not fighting a running back. They're chasing the football. So I think there's improvement across the board, Newell, to be honest with you, defensively, from a personnel standpoint, from a depth standpoint, and a talent standpoint. And that even includes the secondary, because I know they've been much maligned, and at times deservedly so, but I think Coach Corey Raymond is getting DBU back where it needs to go. They've got young players who last year, as I said, got meaningful snaps and meaningful games, and they grew up a little bit on the job. They also went out in the transfer portal, number one class in the country, according to those who follow it, and they got some guys who can go out and cover now man-to-man if you need to do that. It's complementary football. If your defensive mm-hmm. front and your linebackers can wreak havoc at the line of scrimmage and in the offensive backfield, that's going to take some pressure off the back end of your defense. Likewise, if they can cover man-to-man and they can lock down on these receivers, it's going to give more time for Harold and West and Jacobian and Jack Pyburn and those guys to get to the quarterback, maybe, you know, get that sack total up, maybe get that strip football up a little bit. I just think the entire package for Blake Baker, whose philosophy is to attack after and try to disrupt these type of high-powered offenses, I think he's got the thoroughbreds now that will – I don't know if it'll be exactly where we want it to be week one, but I think we're certainly headed in the right direction.
I hope, unlike last year, that we start from the very first minute. We seemed to get into a routine of starting slow last year.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that's something Coach Kelly's talked about as well. I mean, it's you got four quarters of play. It's a 60-minute game. There's no reason to kind of get acclimated into the game, you know, your second or third drive or your second or third drive out there defensively. So, and really, I've gotten the sense since early January, and I've told a lot of people this, and Coach and I talked about it last week on a show, it's really hard to delineate the end of 2024 and the start of 2025. I mean, that the work was being done when the clock hit zero in Houston last year. And a lot of it has all been centered around that sense of urgency, not only week one, but snap one, game one. And if you were around the football building the last couple of weeks, there's no doubt in your mind that they've got an important game coming up on the 30th against a top five team. I don't want to say that they put all the emphasis on the opening game of the year, but it's pretty daggone close.
Yeah, when you follow up, you know, with a game against Troy, right? I think is that at Troy or is it?
Yeah, it's are at, you talking about LSU? We got yeah. Louisiana Tech.
No. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong schedule. That's Clemson. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No worries.
What is the follow up game for the Tigers?
Home opener, Louisiana Tech Bulldogs coming
Louisiana
down.
Louisiana Tech. That's it. Yeah. Okay. I put it around here somewhere. I can't find it amongst all the papers. You talked about the receivers, and I was talking about speed. I've heard folks say that this could be one of the fastest receiver corps that they've had in a decade.
Yeah, these guys are lightning fast. You know, I mentioned the abundance of riches. You got a healthy Chris Hilton Jr., who played sparingly for the most part at the end of last year, who had a little bit of rust. And, you know, I always talk about guys who come off injury. There's the physical part of it, and then there's the mental part of it. What can I do? When do I feel like I'm 100% confident that my legs, my arms, my midsection is going to allow me to perform the way it did prior to the injury? And I think that takes some time. Chris is good to go. He's an absolute burner. Aaron Anderson, who I think has improved his speed, is probably for the last couple of seasons, one of the more underrated receivers when you talk about guys in the SEC. I think he's a great possession receiver for you, and he can you know, wander around the field and give a target to Garrett. You go out in the portal, you get Nick Anderson. That's kind of his MO, is an absolute speedster, to let him streak right down the seam. And so I think, again, not only is LSU's offense got a returning quarterback, I think you've added to the weaponry he has with Berrion Brown from Kentucky. As I mentioned, Nick Anderson. Kyle Parker is healthy, who I think he's got a bright future ahead of him. Jelani Watkins. I mean, the list goes on and on, not to mention whether or not you're going to go with Bauer, the tight end transfer from Oklahoma, which is a little more like your traditional tight end, or Tre'Davious Green, who is almost uncoverable from a defensive perspective at that tight end position as maybe really an extra receiver. I think Garrett's going to have the ability to stretch the defense when he wants to. He's going to have the short stuff to dink and dunk if they need it, and he's going to have the intermediate passes. And he's got great players at all of those levels offensively.
And is there someone new joining you in the booth, Jacob Hessler?
Yeah, he joined us last year. He'll be back
this
season. Yeah. So, yeah, happy to have number 18, Jacob Hester, in there with us, along with Gordy Rush on the sidelines. And I'm sitting here right now trying to get everything ready, so we'll be ready to go when boot meets ball Saturday night.
All righty. Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Fighting Tigers. Can't wait to listen to you on Saturday night, man. Thank you so much for joining us. And have a great weekend. Bring home that win. No pressure. Just bring it home.
You got it. As always, thank you, Noah. Always appreciate chatting with you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, we are going to have a special edition of the Port of New Orleans show tomorrow with both Beth Branch, the president and CEO of Port NOLA, and Michael Heck, president and CEO of GNO Inc. And we'll be talking about the importance of the Louisiana International Terminal. So we look forward to that tomorrow, and that'll be an interesting conversation to have both of them, and we're just going to have a rambling conversation about a number of the important issues relative to that project. And you still have a chance to win a portable generator. We're now right in the midst of the hurricane season, and we know everybody worries about losing power. WWL wants to help ease your mind, so we teamed up with Craig's Electrical and Generator Service to offer you the chance to win a portable generator. We're talking about a Generac GP6500 portable generator. I've seen this thing, folks. It is unbelievable. Total value, almost $1,000. You can enter to win once every day. So start now. Go to WWL.com/contest for your chance to win backup power from Craig's Electrical and Generator Service, because when the power goes off, Craig comes on, and WWL Louisiana Official Emergency Management Station. So don't forget about getting in there and getting that done. And we're also going to have our segment with the St. Tammany Economic Show with Lacey Osborne, CEO and President of the St. Tammany Chamber of Commerce. A lot going on in the North Shore as well. We'll be right back, folks. Check in with Scoot when we return. Well, folks, we covered a lot of territory today. I hope you enjoyed today's show. That segment with Sheriff Joe Lapinto relative to deploying first responder drones. That is absolutely incredible. Really excited about that, and totally excited about the LSU-Clemson game this weekend. So glad to have college football starting, and Scoot joins us. Scoot, were you yelling from your balcony that Taylor Swift got engaged?
You know, I'm excited for her. I mean, this seems like a true love story. I mean, you know, it might have been kind of a publicity thing in the beginning for both of them, understanding that the, you know, the publicity spike was good for both of them. But that might have been fun, but I think they truly have fallen in love. So I'm really very happy for them. Charlie Kirk, the conservative host, has some really interesting advice for Taylor Swift. We'll talk about that. Also, Remembering Katrina 20 years later does continue with Kermit Ruffins and a few others on the show today, and we'll talk about that shooting at a Catholic school in Minneapolis.
Scoot's headed your way, folks, with a great lineup. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Tuesday evening. We'll see you tomorrow.